This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, greetings out there to everybody at TFMR. Hey, it is Thursday, April the 9th. That means it's time for a Thursday conversation, and I have a special treat for you, something that I've looked forward to now for a couple of weeks since we set it up. And of course, that is a return visit follow-up conversation with my old, really stress the old term, friend, Chris Martinson. We've known Chris for a long time, and his service at peakprosperity.com is invaluable. But his wisdom these last 90 days or so, with his actual background as a PhD in pathology, his wisdom in anticipating the problems of this virus and warning as many people as possible has, I mean, talk about invaluable. So many will recall that in late January, right after China confirmed human-to-human contact, Chris, man, the red flags went up, and I reached out to him, and on Saturday, January 25th, we recorded a podcast that to this day just remains extraordinarily valuable information. Now it's time to follow up. So anyway, my friend, with that lengthy introduction, thank you so much for your time.
Craig, it's really great to be back with you. And, you know, somebody sent me that interview around again, like, oh, God, this was great. And so I just started listening to it because I'm like, geez, what was I saying on the 25th? And about 5 minutes in, I'm like, geez, we really got this pretty right, yeah. You know?
Yeah, you did.
You know, compared to the CDC, we got it really right. You know?
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and look, the work you've done almost every day since in really putting the truth out and getting people to understand what was happening, you know, kind of picking them by the lapels and shaking them. You know, I know a lot of folks on my side immediately went out and bought elderberry gummy bears, you know, and a handful of N95 masks because nobody wanted to hoard that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us really prepared. I can't even remember how many Fridays in February I wrapped up my weekly podcast by saying, okay, now go. Use this time. Be smart. You know, you don't want to be number 1001 at Costco when the time comes. And we owe that to you. So thank you.
Oh, you're most welcome. And I've received outreach from all over the world, literally every corner of it, from people who could listen. You know, and I think that's where your tribe and my tribe share something, is that these are people who can hear stuff that's not what's being spoon-fed to them by the media and decide for themselves what they want to do. And I'm really gratified by how many people took action. Like, yeah. You know, oh my God, my family's, you know, we got the masks, we didn't hoard, we got ready, and we feel great, you know, compared to other people who got slammed with that adjustment reaction and you know, went from it's just the flu, bro, to oh my God, we're all going to die. You know, it's just that's like a really rough transition. And yeah. The people listen to you and me, they didn't go through that, which is valuable. Really is.
Stressful enough as it is, for crying out loud. Easing into it, I can't even imagine. You know, you just wake up one morning and get slapped in the face with, you know, what's happening. But anyway, it's again, just invaluable what you've done. You've got your YouTube channel, which obviously people should subscribe to. But it just, you know, quickly tell them everybody about Peak Prosperity, because you've been doing that now for more than a decade. What, 12 years, something like that?
Yeah, the Crash Course came out 12 years ago, 2008. Needs a little updating, and we're in the process of doing that. But, you know, that really talked about the big picture stuff. I'm a big picture guy. And so, you know, when I called for the housing crash back in 08, that was just because it was commonsensically obvious mm-hmm. that hairdressers in Vegas shouldn't own 19 houses, right? You know, and it turned out to be right, you know. And here again, watching this pandemic unfold, you know, the virology of it's fairly, that was easy to get right. I'm surprised so many ostensibly professional virologists got it wrong, because, I mean, it just all the characteristics like that's a pandemic, right? So that was easy. But, you know, what's harder, Craig, is the complexity of our bubble economy getting slammed like that. I think people do not yet understand just how much damage has actually been done structurally to a structurally deficient economy and financial system.
Yeah, no doubt about it. That you can't bounce right back from. Any question, no question. I mean, think of that. I always had this metaphor in my mind of, you know, Chairman Powell with holding a bunch of sticks with the plate spinning.
Yeah.
You know, and just trying to keep them going by putting money here, money here, money here, keeping them spinning. Well, now not only have they stopped spinning, but they've all, you know, crashed and shattered.
Yeah.
And it's hard to put that back together. Okay, so anyway, everybody knows from these Thursday conversations, we try to stay on point with just a couple, two or three questions, you know, main specific topics. And today, really, for Chris, I really only just have two. I mean, we could talk about the virus and everything that's going on and shifting the curve and, you know, all of this stuff. But I mean, most folks, I think, listening understand that. I mean, we're all paying attention now. So I don't want to waste your time with that, because, like I said, not wasting your time with it, but you know what I'm saying. I want to kind of go in a different direction. So let's do this. In your mind, right now, here we are, April the 9th, what do people do? Because, I mean, people have prepared, okay? What are the steps people should take now?
Ooh, in which dimension? I mean,
yeah.
So first, you know, we're going to be figuring out how to wander out of our homes, blinking into the bright light and getting back to work somewhat, right? So everybody's just got to begin to adjust their thoughts and habits and practices around that. So, you know, we're all going to wear masks. We're going to keep a little bit more distance from each other. We're going to have to be careful about this, because just because we flatten the curve and, oh my gosh, you know, hospitalizations are falling and deaths are falling, don't think that this honey badger virus, which is what I'm calling it, because it's such a lethal foe that's so scrappy and hard to deal with, don't think it can't come roaring back out and swamp us again. So that's part one. Part two is, because of that, though, Craig, because of that, so many things have changed, you know? And I hate to put it this way, but if you owned a place where people gathered, or you worked at a place where people gathered, I think that's toast for a good long time. Not just because of the epidemiology of it, because we're going to have to maintain our distance until we have a vaccine, but because people get changed by these experiences, you know? And I, for one, I'm not taking cruises anymore. You know, I'm going to think twice before I get on a plane. So if you own a bar or restaurant, things like that, I think you just got to read the writing on the wall and understand that if that comes back, it's coming back as a shadow of itself for a while, you know?
Yeah.
And so lots has changed, and I know it's a lot to digest, but I think people need to begin asking and answering the question for themselves: what's changed in the world forever, potentially, and how does that impact me? So big question, right? Because, you know, it's going to impact a lot of folks differently, right? So if you were a bartender, it probably impacts you more than somebody who's able to, you know, adjust insurance claims from home, right? So that's that. So huge changes in the job market, the structure, all that stuff. But the final thing is, I think people still need to be even more prepared. And by that, I mean, I'm advising people, you know, plant a garden. The reason for that is, that's code speak for, you should see the data I'm reeling in about farms, plantings, things like that. The vegetable crop didn't go in the Central Valley because they didn't allow 200,000 migrant workers to get the visas to come over the border because, hey, we're not doing mass migrations of folks right now and all kinds of stuff. So I'm a little concerned about you know, what's going to happen with our at least fresh vegetables, you know, going forward into the next year and things like that. So, again, hard to overestimate just how profoundly everything has changed here.
No, I think that's excellent advice, because, again, you have to look ahead, right? You can't just react to what happened today. You have to be proactive, especially in an environment like this. Do you even think, Chris, I mean, we all, even like Prime Minister Trudeau said, yeah, we're not going to do jack until 18 months goes by and we have a vaccine. By 2023, do you think, or is this a permanent adjustment, or do you think, okay, you know, grudgingly, we kind of go back to sitting in packed stadiums?
You know, I would like to say, oh, you know, hey, we're all going back to normal. This is just a little blip. We'll get past it. But the problem is, we still don't know that much about this foe. This coronavirus is a real beast. It's only 38 kilobits of information, right? 38,000, you know, RNA chunks. You know, it's just like, come on. But look what it does. Like, it's like, so we're getting all this crazy data now, which says maybe there's secondary infections, or maybe it goes dormant for a while, reactivates. We don't know. Is it going to go away for the summer? We don't know. If people do get antibodies, do they stay in the body long enough to confer seasonal or year-long or longer sort of immunity? We don't know. You know, because there's some things like tetanus, you know, you go and you get a booster every 10 years and that lasts you 10 years.
Right.
But coronaviruses, you can get a cold every year. And that's from the same one, because for whatever reason, the cold virus doesn't lead to lasting immunity. So we don't know. So I think the safest thing to say is, if we're lucky, we get a vaccine in a year. And then it still takes a half a year. That's, I think, where the 18 months comes out, to manufacture it at scale and get it in everybody and all of that. So I think the safe thing to bet is for 12 to 18 months, kind of what you see now is kind of what you're going to get in terms of social distancing and all that. So the correct question to ask is, what really honestly changes given that? And so many answers to that question. It's pretty much, let me put it this way, what's not coming back is our credit-driven bubble economy where, you know, somebody's going to be paying, plunking down $62,500 for a tricked-out Ford F-150 to help drive them to their pizza delivery job. That ain't happening. That's not coming back.
No, that's right. That's right. And that's probably a whole other topic. That's another one that we need to explore sometime soon. About what replaces it, you know, because people talk about the big reset and debt jubilee and that sort of thing. Well, I don't know. You know, that's the problem with a debt-based system. It's also considered an asset. You know, it ends up on the other side of somebody else's ledger. Yeah. And boy, that makes it very challenging going forward with this monetary system. But anyway, that's a topic for another day. The second topic for today, and this is where I really wanted to pick your brain, was just risk, managing risk, personal risk, risk that we as human beings are willing to take living our lives. And that now is changing with this virus. Now, it's been perceived so far, Chris, you know, and you've done a great job of documenting it all, you know, the case fatality rate of 4% or 6%, that sort of thing. But when you break into that further, so I apologize, this is going to be a long question. I'm used to talking all the time. All right, so when you break into that further, though, most of those fatalities are coming out of a certain maybe age group or subgroup, you know, people with these comorbidities, right? Mm-hmm. So it's broadcast out, you know, that it's got this, you know, we have this case fatality rate. And I think everybody was willing to play along because understanding that you couldn't just overwhelm the medical system, you know, with people dying in the hallways, you know, like we saw a video out of Iran or things like that. Everybody wants to avoid that, okay? So what I'm driving at here is we get to a point where, okay, I think we've got that part under control, hopefully, second waves, all that stuff notwithstanding. Then we take a step back and look at the numbers. And just in a gross oversimplification, Chris, let's say the case fatality rate is 4%. You know, across everything. But then again, now that's assuming that we've tested everybody that actually had it, you know, and we know that's not true. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the data, right, out of Iceland or Italy, places like that. So let's say that we've under-tested by half, and that denominator is twice as large as what we really think, and so now the case fatality rate is 2%. And again, I'm just painting a broad, oversimplified picture.
Yep.
Out of New York, so far, where you got to figure the data is right, we know the number is something like 85 or 86% of the deaths have some type of comorbidity of hypertension or diabetes or, you know, immunosuppressed problem, you know, whatever. So if we move 85% out of the 2%, we're left with kind of a population at large that doesn't have comorbidities. It's younger, you know, fit, whatever, lucky. It has a case mortality rate that's now under 0.5%. So do we at some point, relatively soon, because I think most people know, unless you live in this kind of money, magic money tree, MMT imaginary world, where you think you can just print as many trillions as you need for 18 months, most people know we've got to get back out and keep, you know, moving to some extent. So at what point, what do we need from data? What do we need from perception? What do we need from human nature to get this to where it's an acceptable risk? Like, I know when I drive down the freeway to go to work, I know there's a chance somebody might come through the guardrail and wipe me out. It happens a couple times a month. I'm just banking it's not going to be me. How do we get this virus into that manageable risk category? See, I told you it'd be a long question, but now you can have at it.
All right. So many dimensions to that. So let me start peeling that apart. So the first thing is, if I was in charge, right, I'd wave my little magic wand and I would tell the CDC, would you stop shaming people for wanting to wear masks, which is perfectly normal and correct and scientifically valid, and start collecting data, because what we need is the data here, because it's true that for the most part, and I don't want to minimize this, it's the elderly. You know, if you're over 80 and you have a comorbidity, your chances of dying from this are pretty high. You know, but the truth is that young people are getting taken out, right? People in their 20s, 30s, 40s are dying, right? And we don't know why yet, right? Why is this person going down the bad path and everybody else seems to recover okay? It's like a really terrible flu, but you get past it, you know? And even of the people who recover, Craig, some of them are coming out with permanent lung scarring and damage, right? So one, we'd like to collect the data. It's like, oh my God, you know, this is where AI ought to come in, push all the patient records in there, and AI will go, oh my God, if you took selenium 3 weeks before your zinc levels dropped, you know, plus or whatever, there's some story in there we don't know yet. So A, we got to get that data. B, we got to get the other data, which is who's actually got this and who's cleared of it at this point in time, which would mean two types of tests. One, the PCR test tells you who actively has it. The second test is an antibody test that says who's cleared it from their system and now has an antibody circulating in their body. So we need to know that, because everybody who's already had it has the antibody ought to be cleared to go back to work. Like they're actually gold in this story. They can go wander down hallways full of people coughing and nothing's going to happen. Maybe they, you know, they could help out in hospitals first, wherever we need them most right away. That's how we start to get back around this thing. Now, the problem that we have in this story is we don't actually know how lethal this is going to be. So let me. Here's an issue. So, and this file this under self-inflicted wound, and I think there's some positives that are going to come out of this virus. One, I'm never going to have to sit on a plane with some jerk three rows behind me sweating and sneezing into the air, right? Because we won't tolerate that anymore, right? Which I never liked, because I understand germs. I'm like, Jesus Christ, you know, stop that. And so that'll be good. But the other thing we have to factor in here is, here are the top three risk factors for this thing. Well, there's four big ones, so I'll throw them all in there. Obesity, hypertension, some sort of congestive heart failure or ischemic heart disease, and then finally cancer, either active or in the past 5 years. So when you actually put those things, and we call those comorbidities, you know, 30% of the people in the U.S. are obese, half suffer from some form of hypertension, millions and millions and millions of people with cancer, past or present, and so on. So it's actually not just like, ah, there's just a few people with comorbidities.
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, big chunk of the country.
Yeah, that's true.
And so that's why we can't just let it out. Just, oh, let's just let this thing sweep across. It'll be a bad couple of months, you know, but then we're free and we get back to life. Because the second part of the story that's problematic, we don't know how to control this risk. Data just came out of China, to get into the data real quick, where they measured antibody levels in people who'd been confirmed and had recovered from COVID, from this virus. Really disturbing and fairly disappointing to me. 30% of them did not have sufficient antibodies in them to provide any benefit to fight this thing off if they were re-exposed to it.
Right. Saw that too.
Almost 6% of them had no detectable antibodies whatsoever. So, hey, cool, 38 kilobits of information. Somehow the immune system can fight this off without mounting an antibody response. Who knew? But at the same time, we don't know. Are these people now immune? Is there some new pathway that they are no longer immune, or are they going to catch it again? And if they catch it a second time, is that worse or less bad than the first time? We don't know, right? So all those things are kind of unknowns, which, you know, I can calculate how many times people are going to come through guardrails, make sense of that, and that's the problem. We need the data. Our government's done a crappy job of going about getting that data in a comprehensive or structured way.
Yeah. So, I mean, without the data, like you said, you really can't do anything concrete. I mean, it's just guesswork, right?
Yeah. And so with those comorbidities, even if we said, oh, the younger people, they're fine. So let's call the younger people under 40, right? You know, if you said to those, to the under 40 crowd, 0.5% of you, well, with comorbidities, okay, it's 1% of you. If you said to 200 of them, hey, two of you are going to die if you go into this nightclub tonight. Yeah. Nobody's going in that nightclub.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Well, okay, that's what I needed to hear from you, because I always say, you know, you know more about this than anybody else. You're the smartest guy I know, and this has been bothering me for a couple of days. Because I just know, Chris, we can't keep doing this, though. It's against human nature. It's against the way a lot of people are programmed, you know, to just stay inside and be told what to do and that sort of thing. And we know economically, I mean, we just, people don't have the savings to be able to just pay their rent and their car payment and all this kind of stuff and, you know, just stay at home.
Yeah. So let me give you the glimmer of hope here, though.
Okay.
It's not a glimmer. This is actually a pretty bright light at this point in time. So we've had these studies that have come out now with the hydroxychloroquine,
right,
with zinc and azithromycin. It's a triple pack thing, right? So you need all three of those. Right now, our government is busy running – God, we're such idiots here. For whatever reason, I think Big Pharma wraps into this story. We're running a study where they're only administering hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, no zinc, right? Every single practitioner out there knows that it's – the hydroxychloroquine is an ionophore that allows zinc to get into the cell, and that's what protects you because the zinc gets inside your cells, right? So we're leaving out we've provided the key – but we're not providing the thing that the key allows to enter, right? So it's almost guaranteed to fail. But for the people listening, the results, anecdotal at this point, because I haven't seen the controlled double blind studies, blah blah blah. But all the data coming out of the clinicians now is saying this works. And so even if you don't have hydroxychloroquine at your proposal, the quin, that part is quinine, right? So
right.
No. So what am I doing? There's a number of things that provide ionophores to people. This isn't medical advice, but let me tell you what I'm doing that I think is going to protect me, not just from this, but from other future viruses. I think this is, the pharma company. For whatever reason, this information has been out there for a long time, but we haven't been actively promoting it as a nation, right? You know, but who knew, right? But here's what works. There's things like quercetin is a natural plant product that does the same ionophore activity. Quinine, like you would find in Schweppes tonic water, right?
Right.
Plus zinc, not just any old zinc, but some nice bioavailable form like zinc picolinate, right? Just give yourself a little zinc in either, you know, some tonic water and or, you know, the quercetin, and you've got the natural analog of this the stuff that seems to be working. And again, not medical advice, but you know, these are ordinary supplements. I feel okay telling people about this, but this is what I'm doing, right? And I now, because you know, this was sort of dimly in my awareness, and now COVID has brought this, you know, I've had to really study it and look into it. And I look at this and I realize, good God, this is how we would fight any flu season, right?
Right.
And if we were smart about this, and you know, we didn't allow, you know, those warriors coming, oh, I'm so sick, but I'm still at work. Like we're supposed to be proud of that. Like just stay home, buddy. Right. And, you know, people who are sick now know that they have to mask up. Right. And we have extra awareness not to like, you know, touch things and then rub our eyes, you know, all that stuff. With this, we not only have the chance to beat COVID, but we have the chance to be much healthier going forward by not being dumb and passing all sorts of viruses around every flu and cold season. So I think this is all – I think we're going to come out of this healthier. And by the way, these things I just told you about, the clinical data says it works. So I think if we get more data, I wouldn't be surprised to find we can take that 4%, 2%, 0.5%, 1% with or without comorbidities. And I think we can drop that all the way down closer to zero if the data is right.
And I guess that's ultimately what I'm getting at. First of all, I do have to interrupt. I think you told me that drinking a gin and tonic every day could be good for me.
I did.
I
did not say just one.
Even better. God, it's just, you said you were full of good news. I like it. Okay. But that's that. Okay. So anyway, that's what I'm driving at. Because see, from an investment standpoint, monetary system standpoint, this is the stuff we have to now begin to anticipate and look over the horizon. You warned us. We were able to anticipate and look over the horizon in January and see this coming. But now we have to anticipate and look over the horizon again to see, you know, how we get out. And it's that risk. Again, smartest people in the world are trying to figure out existing substances that are therapeutics until there's a vaccine. And at what point do you have to get that risk, that mortality risk, down to where it's, like I said, just kind of acceptable in the human mind. Again, you like you said, 1,000 people walk into a nightclub, you tell them only 998 are walking out. There's a lot of people that are going to say, I'm not going in. I'm not taking my chances. I'm unlucky.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, we're used to living with risk. That's why I give the freeway example, or just the flu, or cancer, or you know anything else that just is a part of being alive. You have to mentally manage that. So, and I just, in your opinion, just in human nature, I mean, this is just, I'm just, as we wrap up, this is just your speculation. I mean, what do we have to get it down to across the board to get people to go, all right, yeah, fine. Okay, I can handle that.
So this is why I've been doing what I've been doing, which is giving people the information, right? So I go out, I scour, you know, the web, I'm reading science papers, because the feedback I get, which works for me, is like people want the information. Right now it's an unknown. You don't know which two people are going to not come out of that nightclub, right?
Right.
And that, I'm not doing that. But if all of a sudden you're armed with the data and we say, oh, no, it's not just random two out of that 1,000. Actually, these 500 are a little more at risk. Actually, it's these 100. Actually, it's one of you 10, you know?
Yeah.
That's a totally different story, but there we need the data, right? And this is where we're going to have to be a little more scientific as a nation about things and really go in for that full data set. Because once you know what the risk is, you know, then you can – it's calculable in some way. It's knowable.
I don't know
which plane's going to fall out of the air, but I know if I'm flying, you know, a good airline versus Aeroflot, you know, I can, it's different risks, you know, I can manage that. Right. But you're right. Life is risky and nobody should have the expectation of living a completely, you know, risk-free life. And I think that's an okay thing for people to start balancing in because, you know, life is risky. And if you have the mindset that you're never going to die or nothing bad is going to ever happen to you, paradoxically, it means that you're actually not really living either.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think good things are coming out of this, honestly.
Yeah. Long run. You laid that out. Absolutely right. And it's just going to be, I'm just very curious to see, you know, this battle between economic mother nature, monetary mother nature, human nature, and the virus itself and the data, and how, you know, how's this all going to sort itself out in the months ahead is going to be really fascinating to watch. My friend, like I said, you do a fantastic job. And I just thank you so much for all you've done. For folks listening, we're now going to turn the tables. And for Chris's site, we're going to start talking about gold. But for this call, we're going to shut it down. My friend, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure, Craig.
And for everybody listening, thank you for listening. Have a great, relaxing, and peaceful holiday weekend.